Welcome to the Euro Digital Partners Insights Podcast. I'm Sean Patterson. I'm happily joined by another Thunderbird graduate, Dinesh Goel, of LCR Capital Partners. Dinesh was at Thunderbird when I was in the 2000 to 2006 timeframe. Dinesh, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sean. Pleasure to be here with you and your listeners.
Dinesh, for those listeners interested in business school programs, I'm curious to know, what took you to Thunderbird?
So it's an interesting little story. Back when I was looking at business schools, there was a Thunderbird by the name of Aditya Dalmia, who my family happened to know, and I'd connected with him about helping me choose programs. And he recommended Thunderbird to me, and you know, he helped me do my research. And at the end of the day, it so happened that I chose Thunderbird because it was the number one program in global management education at that point of time.
It seems like the world is radically different from that time. Do you think the need for an MBA in international management remains? Or do you think it's the case that the economy changed in such a fundamental way in the last 15 years that we need to rethink these types of programs?
So I think there's been a lot of changes since when you and I went to grad school. But that said, the reality of today's businesses and the world itself is we're more global and more interconnected than we can imagine. At the end of the day, what really matters is what your stream of business is, what your ultimate goal is. But if you look around you, you'll realize that the exposure and the diversity to global interaction and transactions is a lot higher than we give it importance for, right? That's one. The second is, you know, I was very recently speaking with a fellow T-Bird, Kelly Kreiser, if you know of her.
Sure, of course.
And she was telling me about the new programs that Thunderbird is coming up with. They're talking about use of technology, global content, international delivery through 25 global offices, state-of-the-art new campus at Phoenix, Arizona. And at the end of the day, I think what Thunderbird has had to go through over the last 10, 15 years since you and I graduated is also rethink its own strategy. But that said, the focus has always been global education, global management, international education, and exposure to its audiences. While the program itself might go through changes, I think the importance of international management remains, and it only grows with period of time.
Yeah, I wonder if you've been back to the campus, because I think it's been, if I'm not mistaken, functional for some time now. I haven't been there in quite a while. Obviously, the campus is in a completely different location. I think even the curriculum is a little bit different than I remember it.
So I haven't been back at the school since 2014, which is when we had our 10-year reunion. But I think there's a 75th year reunion coming up next fall, I guess in October 21, which I'm looking forward to participating in.
Sounds good to me. I hope I can make it myself. Let's fast forward a little bit. I want to know what you're doing at LCR Capital, how you got there, and what the firm does.
Sure. So LCR Capital Partners is a trusted advisor to global families who are currently and actively seeking U.S. residency and investment options. If you've heard of it, there's a U.S. government program called the EB-5, which delivers U.S. residency via green cards to investors and their families in exchange for an investment for a period of 5 to 7 years. And these programs provide clients and their families access to education, jobs, entrepreneurial opportunities outside of their home countries, especially the US. At the same time, you know, we work very hard to build multi-generational relationships with our clients and are very attached to their families because, you know, an average life cycle of interaction with a client is anywhere, like I said, between 5 to 7 years. And going back to the global theme, our belief is very strongly that foreign investment helps the communities grow stronger, helps diversity, helps create jobs. And so that's what we do as a firm. Interestingly, just about 4 years ago, I was introduced to LCR by a fellow T-Bird, Marcos Guevara, who graduated in 1999, who reached out and introduced me to LCR for their India market entry strategy. And interestingly, at that point in time, I was transitioning from my third entrepreneurial venture and looking at my fourth one and exploring what I wanted to do with that when the LCR opportunity came about trying to help them do their India market entry strategy. And so I did that. But for the first 3 years of my engagement with them, I actually led the sales and the commercial efforts of the firm in India, GCC and Southeast Asia. And in late 2019, I transitioned to a managing director for advisory services and digital strategy globally. As part of my role in advisory services, I'm constantly looking at new products and solutions that support our client families and help them with their goals of being successful globally. At the same time, helps us go with the theme of building multi-generational relationships with our clients. On the digital strategy side, I work with identifying technologies, defining processes, transformation, training, adoption and utilization of new technologies, and making it central to our business. You know, things like sales enablement tools. You know, how do we help our commercial and sales teams across the globe deliver the same value to our clients? I look at digital marketing and how we invest our budgets across platforms globally. And like I said, new products and solutions. So that's part of my role at LCR.
How geographically distributed is the firm? I mean, in a way, you're global, no? Or do you prefer the word international?
I think they're interchangeable a little bit. But just to give you an insight into how global we are as a firm, we have offices in 8 countries, but we have clients in 40 plus countries. We operate as one team across the world. So we're essentially, you know, the first office to open up at a given point of time in a day is Singapore, and the last office to shut the day is our team in LA, right? And so we're actually transitioning from time zone to time zone.
So that spans pretty much the globe.
Correct. So we're in Singapore, we're in India, we're in Dubai, we're in South Africa, we're in Sao Paulo, we're in Miami, we're in Westport, Connecticut, just north of New York. We're in LA. And we've got partners across the world, right? And so what really influences a lot of that is our culture, right? It's the same mission and same values across offices, across teams, and technology. I mean, everything from using Slack for internal communication to HubSpot for tracking global work streams going on parallelly, and be it shared drives and all of that. So essentially, it's a seamless global operation, be it commercial, be it client services, be it compliance. And so while we're fairly geographically distributed, we're also a global firm that is working seamlessly on the operation side.
Well, speaking of global firm, you must have had to deal with COVID-19, the pandemic, pretty early on, because at the same time that some people are panicking about it in, say, East Asia, people in LA must have been thinking, no big deal. What is this virus? It must have been strange to see sort of the virus spread across the world and affect each of your offices at a slightly different time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up. And I'm actually personally based in India. And so, you know, when you look at how India was responding or how we were evaluating things, I'll split that answer in two parts, personally and as a firm. Personally, I think, you know, being someone who has a low immunity system, I had actually a watch out on coronavirus fairly early in early to mid-Feb. And actually, funnily, I'm someone who travels about 15 days a month for the last 10 odd years. And actually had my last international trip outside the country on the 6th of February. And so that's how early I'd started tracking that. And so
that's pretty early.
Yeah. I mean, geographically, we're very close to China, right? And as India, we're very close to China. We're right across the border. But we'd started tracking it fairly early personally. And, you know, that's how the exchange started happening internationally and globally within the offices. And we as a firm decided to, you know, respond as and how needed. What we've been able to do since I think, I would say mid-March, is we've been able to transition our team completely to work from home. And we care very deeply about our people, right? And we're a small team, but a very efficient team. And so we've been able to, you know, as a firm, decide how we want to respond to it locally. And so there's a global aspect to it, right? The other part is, as a firm, the senior management of the firm, the partners, and of course, you know, our chairman and CEO, they've been very nice to fund personal protective equipment, be it sanitizers or face shields or anything that you need personally and locally for the team. So all you got to do is just send it upstream and you get an approval to buy those locally. So it's been interesting, right? I mean, we've been tracking coronavirus for a while now, and I think we've responded fairly well in a manner where none of our team members are impacted personally by coronavirus.
I mean, that's fantastic. How has it affected your interaction with clients? Because your business is famously face-to-face, conducted over handshakes and tea. How does a world where we interact over FaceTime and Zoom change your schedule?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and thank you for bringing it up. 95% of our business is based on in-person interaction. In late 2019, we had a 15-country roadshow, and I'm talking October, November 2019, with almost everyone in the firm traveling, which resulted in our most successful business year ever, financially, right? Having been on the sales and commercial side, I can share with you that traditionally, I have served only one client that I haven't met personally before they became a client. So from an introduction to signing on with paperwork, there's only one client historically that became a client without an in-person meeting. And I've served in my 3 years on the sales and commercial side, I've served over 160 clients myself. That said, when I transitioned into the role of Managing Director for Advisory Services and Digital Strategy, our digital transformation actually began at the beginning of the year itself. We were already thinking of ways and working and evaluating technologies which we could use to form relationships with our clients without such a heavy dependence on in-person meetings. That said, all of that has had to be condensed into a much shorter cycle of implementation. The transition to an online world has been interesting and challenging. You know, it's not just about using Zoom or Skype or you know, Google or FaceTime. It's about changing the whole culture of the firm itself. It's about adopting processes that deliver the same results, right? And the positives for us have been that, you know, we're a firm that has a very entrepreneurial culture. We're a firm where everyone on the team believes in the purpose of the firm. And we have no boundaries globally. I mean, like I said, we work in different time zones, but we're all constantly working and thinking of how we can make our business flourish and better. So it's been an interesting transition so far.
Yeah, I mean, I have the impression talking with other people in business, and first of all, congratulations on last year's success. That's great. I'm just wondering, it seems to me a lot of people are foreseeing permanent change here. And I'm wondering if you see that for your firm as well.
You know, there's a couple of thoughts to that. One is, I do believe that some things will go back to normal. For example, the world will go back to travel and vacationing in other countries, right? There's no doubt about it. However, on the flip side is, this has been a long period of lockdown for the world, and something that we as a generation, or at least a generation before us, or even two for that matter of fact, hasn't seen this kind of restrictions implemented. And these long period of changes are sometimes habit forming. So while in-person interaction going forward will still be required, but we might not need it as much. And to give you a short example, you know, where we were meeting with clients probably 3, 4, 5 times before they went from an introduction to a sign up, we'd probably do the in-person meeting either at the beginning to build that faith and, you know, that then get things going. Or we might do it towards the end where we've figured out everything else and it's more a handshake or namaste, as it's going to be called. Now, I'll give you another example. I think the world over, we've seen the concept of online payments interaction, and especially in the developed world. What you'll see happen in the developing world is pretty phenomenal. I'll give you an example. India actually went through, you know, an 8 to 9 week complete lockdown, right? And traditionally, as a family, we were used to going and picking our own fruit and vegetable at the supermarket, at the store, or the vegetable vendor, and then picking it up. Now, what has changed is every 3 to 4 days, we're now placing orders for the very basic things online, right? That is being delivered to India, so much like what's happening in the US, with a completely seamless online payment and a no-touch delivery or a no physical interaction delivery. When you extrapolate that on 1.3 billion people, just imagine the impact of how habit-forming this can be.
Yeah, it completely changes so much of your life. I mean, because that's such a common task for us, right?
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, like I said, some things will go back to normal, but some things will have become so ingrained in our nature and our habits that we'd be happy to continue those, even post-coronavirus. So to your question, I mean, some things will change permanently and some things might or might not. So the jury's still out on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I guess to bookend that, you know, what I would point out is that we're still figuring this out. We're still in the midst of the pandemic. I don't think there's any playbook yet formed on how to deal with the pandemic. And I guess time will tell. But I want to focus a little bit more on the marketing side now. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about LCR Capital Partners' marketing strategy before the COVID-19 crisis hit.
Sure. So traditionally, 95% of our business actually comes from referral partners, such as wealth management firms and banking partners or existing clients, and also from industry colleagues. And so traditional forms of business have relied on in-person interaction and face-to-face meetings. So it's a very value-based relationship, right? It's a relationship that's built on trust and with time. In terms of marketing itself, like I said, since a lot of our business is based on referrals from existing clients and partners, you're doing a lot of in-person interaction, right? That's the traditional method. I also shared that we did a 15-country roadshow towards the end of last year, which was our most, you know, phenomenal year financially. And so that's extremely important. That said, we're a firm that believes that we present ourselves and our values in a very strong manner. And at the same time, we like to focus on the value that we deliver to our clients. So traditionally, before coronavirus, a lot of our marketing was based on how do we enhance the experience of the customer who we're meeting or who is being referred to us.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems to me that your company is really selling a story. I mean, storytelling for LCR seems particularly important, maybe more than the average firm. I'm curious to know, what kind of pictures do you paint for prospective clients?
So again, going back to our business, like I've shared, the fact of the matter is that we're a firm that works with families and is a trusted advisor to global families who are exploring the U.S. residency option or a U.S. investment option, right? Now, both are not mutually exclusive, but think about it from a perspective of somebody who wants to is based in India or Brazil or Croatia, for that matter of fact, invests in a U.S. business or invests in a U.S. project in the EB-5 program and subsequently transitions to the U.S., it's a fairly large investment of $900,000 to begin with. And then eventually also brings, either creates wealth that stays in the United States or brings more wealth from their home country or their global investments back to the United States. And so that's essentially the story that we're telling. Is the storytelling is regarding how powerful the U.S. is in general. I mean, think about it for a minute. Is the U.S. economy is the U.S. economy currently and for the foreseeable future will continue to be the world's largest economy. It is the world's largest consumer market in terms of just the average spend. And the US dollar will continue to be the primary currency of the world. Historically, there have been so many examples of immigrants coming to the United States and succeeding. I mean, from what I understand, there's over 60% of immigrant entrepreneurs end up achieving strong entrepreneurial objectives. Investments in the US have done really well for immigrant businesses. Right. So we build stories around that. And so it's not just our clients, but generally the concept of immigrant success stories. That said, I can share a couple of very interesting examples of client profiles with you. You know, I've met this client family in Dubai a few years ago who eventually did become our client. And they wanted to explore the U.S. residency option for their child because she wanted to pursue forensic science and her dream was to be able to go work for FBI or CIA,
the only way you're going to get into that is, you know, first you get U.S. residency and then you become a U.S. citizen, technically, right? So that's one example. The other example is from a family in India whose, you know, son, when I met them, I was blown away by just the amount of passion this child had for astronomy and cosmology. And his dream was to go work for NASA or SpaceX. The only way you're going to be able to do that is through a U.S. residency option. So there's such, I mean, so the only way you're going to be able to achieve some of these goals is to be able to attain U.S. residency. And if you are a U.S. either green card holder or a citizen, right? And so there's so much storytelling that happens in our business on an everyday basis.
Fast forward to February, March of this year. We're a few months now into the pandemic. What changes have you made to the business and marketing strategy as a result?
Sure. So as you can imagine, there's been a tremendous transformation in the way we look at our business. It's about changing your tactics, but making sure that you communicate and deliver the same message and value, both through marketing and operations, from an offline heavy execution to an agile digital world. Right? So, for example, like I shared, you know, it moved from roadshows to online roadshows, webinars. At the same time, global ad campaigns have always been global ad campaigns, but at the same time, we spun them into local languages. We were reaching audiences in person in their home countries and languages. We just took that and made sure that we were doing the same thing online. Right, we were communicating them in a language that they understood, that they're comfortable with, and that they like interacting with. At the same time, using technology for our global teams, but obviously we're distributed locally in India, for example, in Dubai and in Singapore, they're interacting with the same set of customers who are local to them, but because there's restrictions and lockdowns, they're meeting them online, right? So the fact of the matter is that we've transitioned, or we're working on transitioning in different manners and different domains of our business, the ability to sell a $1 million product without meeting face-to-face, right? And the way you do that is, A, people love authenticity. And so, you know, it's about being honest and it's about being transparent. It's about building trust. And so we have a track record now of being able to look someone in the eye and build that trust just because we're honest, transparent, authentic. But the only difference is, where you were heavily reliant on doing that in person, you're now doing that online. And like I said, it's about globalization of marketing while keeping the local cultural sensitivities in mind.
You're pretty early on, I guess. We're only a few months into this pandemic. It sounds like you've made some well thought out changes. Are you starting to see results from these changes, or is it still too early on?
The fact of the matter is, you know, our business has gone through a very big transition and transformation in the last few months. Let me give you some insights into that. Aside of the challenges of the pandemic itself, you know, there's been a price change. You know, so where we were looking at earlier, an average client was $500,000 client, we've transitioned to almost $1 million client. To be, you know, client has to have invested at least $1 million with us to become a client.
Okay. And why the requirement? What's the benefit?
So, you know, part of it is the regulation changes, both on the US government side and in our business.
Okay.
You know, there's been so many developments geopolitically. You're obviously seeing what's happening between United States and some of the other ally countries.
Right. Yeah.
There's exchange rate variations because of coronavirus and the economy fluctuations, right? There's been a massive exchange rate fluctuations. For example, in Brazil, the currency's fallen against the dollar has fallen on almost 20% in the year, this year itself, right? And then we're also seeing protectionist measures by certain countries, right? For example, there have been strong exchange rate exchange controls being executed by the Indian government. And so our business is going through a lot of different changes, a lot of different variables are moving very quickly. So it's been a hard 6 months generally. And also, generally speaking, you know, when you go through such a transition, it's hard to measure in such a short period. But we've, as a firm, if you look at what we've just talked about, we've proven that we can be agile. We've proven that we can deliver values, you know, our values, and at the same time, given our values, we can deliver value to our clients despite all of those changes. We're now going into half the year from January to June without having to furlough or lay off any of our people, because we look at our team as an LCR family. You know, everyone on the team is handpicked and cherry-picked into the role that they're executing. But also the feeling, the general feeling that I get from, you know, watching all these transitions is that people are not really delaying the decision to do business. They're committed to doing business, be it our clients or be it our partners. It's just that the physical meeting is postponed for a little while.
Okay.
Also, you know, when you react to a situation versus when you respond to a situation, there's a difference. And so we're trying to do the latter a lot more. That's our commitment to being in the business and being committed to our clients and being committed to delivering our you know, objectives and reaching our mission and vision for the long term.
Well, yours, speaking of agility, is a younger firm. So it's born in the digital age.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking maybe you're a little bit more digital savvy than some older firms.
Yeah.
And speaking of the finance industry, how do we move to purely digital for relationship building? It seems to me that there must be some channels that you think are more relevant or some tools that are better for doing just that.
That's another very interesting question. You know, let me give you some insights without, you know, really talking about specific tools, but we're now tracking how our clients are consuming the information that we're sharing with them, right?
Sure.
We're tracking various platforms. We're tracking how they're engaging with the various platforms. There's, you know, seamless integration and communication tracking. So for example, when somebody visits our website to when we send them an email, we're actually able to track how long they're spending on reading a particular page or how long they're spending on reading an email that we sent them, right? That gives us a lot of client information and tells us what part of information that we're sharing with them is exciting for them, is, you know, engaging them a lot more. We're handing over communication to stakeholders within and outside the firm for each business opportunity, right? I mean, so as you can imagine, at $1 million per client, obviously we're a very high touch business, and it's not that we're tracking hundreds of millions of clients. We're tracking a very small subset of clients globally. Our clients are higher in value and lower in numbers.
Sure.
And so there's a very seamless handover of communication between various stakeholders, you know, to get a transaction done, be it on the sales side or the commercial side or the compliance side or the marketing side or the digital side or the advisory services side. Essentially, there's various stakeholders who are participating in an interaction and transaction for each client. And so the handover is very, very smooth, right? We're also tracking our budget spends, for example. We're tracking, you know, what we're spending on Google, what we're spending on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, or any of those. And we're actually seeing very different behavioral patterns of how either potential or existing customers interact with a piece of content when it's on Google or when it's on LinkedIn or when it's on Facebook, right? So we're tracking all of that. From a finance world perspective itself, look, artificial intelligence-based and machine learning-based advisory and tracking of consumer behavior is already occurring. It's a reality. Very recently, I was reading this article which said, a lot of wealth management firms are now moving their customers to AI-based financial product advisory, right? That's just an example. One of the things that we're looking at, what we're tracking is, as per regulations and compliance, ideally a customer would have to sign papers in person and then ship it to us, right? The regulations have now accepted digital signatures instead of wet signatures. And this is US government regulations. So we're actually looking at very, 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 very closely in terms of what kind of secure technology can we bring to our platform and to our customers, which will enable that, which is compliant with the US government standards. So I think this whole process is making us think like a fintech. It's pushing us to think like a fintech. And so my personal belief is that over a period of time, we will see significant changes in the finance industry, and it will be very reliant on technology, and it will be very reliant on the digital world. That said, it does not remove the importance of the concept of building trust and faith with your clients.
So let me end with this. I want to talk about the outlook. What's your outlook for the rest of 2020 into 2021, both personally, professionally, for the industry? What are your thoughts?
The fact of the matter is our business is very global. In fact, all businesses today are very global in nature. But this coronavirus or the lockdown has proven that we can function globally without actually meeting, right? The lockdown has driven everyone in any business to think about how to be a digital business going forward.
Sure.
I shared our own example. It's forcing us to think like a fintech, right? And it's driving a lot of our thinking. Technology itself will evolve. I mean, to give a short example, one of the most popular video online meeting app, without taking names, till 8 weeks ago didn't know the privacy loopholes in their own technology. And they've had to evolve their technology so quickly.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
The evolution of technology itself is driven by what the consumer needs and what the consumer wants. And so as consumers of technology, I think technology itself will evolve over a period of time. That said, you know, and again, I want to emphasize this, is building the trust will always remain important, be it in an offline world or in an online world. And more so in the online world, at least till a certain point in the transaction process itself, in certain, you know, you're going to have to build trust through that process of the transaction cycle, right? At the same time, technology companies will have to be very mindful, from, you know, on behalf of their consumers at least, is that you'll have to address cultural differences on how technology can be used and will be used. I give you an example, right? I mean, in terms of China, US, Korea, the way these countries interact with technologies is very different, even in 2020, in terms of how they, you know, exchange transactions or how they conduct transactions or how they conduct business in comparison to how India, Brazil, and some of the other countries do, right? So it will also be a process of adoption of technologies across various cultures. So as a firm, for example, one of the things that we're trying to do and we're trying to monitor very quickly is if I move or introduce a process into a certain technology, it has to be ready for adoption by my global team.
Sure. Okay.
So it cannot be that I'm introducing a separate technology for Singapore and a separate one for Dubai. It has to be seamless integration globally. So my outlook for 2020 and 2021 is businesses will be digitally enabled and, you know, technology will drive that. In the finance world, almost everyone will be forced to think like a fintech. Generally speaking, foreign investments, migration, global transactions and global business will continue to be important. I don't think that's going to change. And at the end of the day, it really will depend on the culture of the firm, the culture of the clients that you interact with, that you're going to have to be mindful of.
Indeed. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for your time, Dinesh. I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Sean. It's a pleasure. And I'm glad that we connected. And I hope this drives some value to your audience.
Oh, absolutely. So that's it, listeners. Again, thanks to Dinesh Goel of LCR Capital Partners, who joined us today from India. That will do it for another edition of the Euro Digital Partners Insights podcast. Find us online at eurodigitalpartners.com/insights. And for comments or suggestions for future episodes, email us at info@eurodigitalpartners.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're there at EUDigitalP. Finally, please leave a 5-star review for us on iTunes and wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. Be sure to head over to beatyourcompetitiononline.com to get enrolled in the best and most practical digital marketing course on the internet. Thanks, and bye-bye.